morning and welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Nation, His kingdom, His people, and your radio station.
Good morning. Welcome to the Remnant Road with Al McCorn, the somewhat choking, almost to the edge of death, Barry Phillips.
I'm here.
Who's being resurrected as we speak, and Mike Clayton. Hey, good morning, guys.
Hey, Barry. Sounds like you're somewhat under the weather.
No, I was under the influence of some grit out of an apple.
Oh, heavens. A gritty apple. That's
It wasn't just grit, sorry.
It was just a little bit of an apple or something that got stuck in my throat, and I had to go get some water. But I think I'm all right.
You know, ever since Eve gave that thing to Adam, we've had that same problem.
You know, yeah. I'm not going there. Me and my wife getting along right now, and I'm not touching it.
Yeah.
Yes, Mike, you're on. Hey.
I had to hit my mute because of a phone call in the background, so I didn't know if it came back on. The little light on my headset's not working. So.
Well, let's get to it. Here we are on December 17th on the Remnant Road. Guys, let me tell you what I'm looking at right now. It is a wedding picture.
Oh,
yeah.
Is we went married?
No. But my niece Renee got married. We went to Lexington, Kentucky this weekend. And this is the fourth wedding in our family in 3 years. We've had two this year. My nephew got married in August. Last year, it was Renee's sister who got married. And 2 years ago, it was my daughter.
It's contagious.
Well, it is, and we got three other young 20s on our side of the family, and two of them have prospects, significant, serious prospects.
Well, you know what that means then, right, Al?
Hey, that means I get to be in your shoes as grandpa one of these days real soon.
Maybe, because it means the rapture's happening today, because they're marrying and giving in marriage, hallelujah.
You know, I will say
that just see Drake had been married.
I did say to my youngest daughter when she got a job at a bridal store a few years back, I said, "No, well, this means that you have job security to the very end of the age because of that prophecy." So now it is wonderful to see young people, godly young people, by the way, get married. And to watch these two young folks who got married on Saturday, as they were doing their first dance, the look on their faces said it all. It was total love. It was total commitment. And it was a godly, holy, beautiful thing. And her young husband is going into the ministry and will be picked up as somewhere, you know, perhaps even in our neck of the woods as a youth minister or something like that. And they've got such an awesome foundation from both families that have built into these young people a love of their God and a desire to serve Him and walk that out their whole lives. And now they want to walk it out together. So as you may tell from my description here, it was definitely a Christian wedding. And oh, by the way, the reception had a very Christmas theme. But even with the differences in the way my family believes and practices, you know, there was a solid core, a solid foundation of this love for our living Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus, as they call him, that united us so that we could all overlook our differences and move forward with what keeps us together.
Mm-hmm.
as you're describing it, I'm thinking of a teaching that Mike forwarded to me. Mike, was it last week? Week before last, from Dr. Miles Monroe. Absolutely continue to be a blessing. The teaching was why men need dreams and visions. And it's a bit lengthy, but I watched it and wept and cried, and then sat down and watched it again with my wife, and we wept and cried. It explains so much about marital discord, mm-hmm. about why men in our generation fail to live righteously and are seemingly lost. But a core understanding from this teaching is that when Adam was introduced to Eve or Chava, he had two things. One, Adam was at Eden, which is the presence of the Most High, and he had already been given his work. That is not his job, but his work. He knew what his calling and purpose was, and he was engaged in pursuing that. And Dr. Monroe made the astute conclusion here, this great insight, that before a man takes a wife, he needs those same two things. He needs the presence of the Most High, and he needs to already know what his calling and purpose is, what his work is, being in pursuit of that. His wife, he marries to help him in that pursuit, adding her gifts, her callings, her abilities, her anointing, that they do it together, but he has to determine what that path is. And so when a man comes and marries a woman and he hasn't figured that out, she's going to be frustrated because she doesn't know mm-hmm. where to apply what she has. And he also made this evaluation that if a woman marries a man and he's not in pursuit of his work, she's going to go ahead and start her own, and then he's going to be intimidated by her.
You know, there's a lot of truth in that.
Oh, there's tons of truth in that. I just sit with my mouth hung open.
Yeah. I met Dr. Monroe. He's he died in a plane crash in 2014, him and his wife. But I had the privilege of meeting him back in 1996, I think it was. Anyone that's never been around, and as with anybody, you know, you don't agree with everything, who cares, whatever. But anybody that has never listened to Dr. Monroe, he was one of the top thinkers of our generation. There is no one that I read his books. His book about purpose is available online. And I give this book to most any youth that I can find. I gave the last one away and had to buy one again myself because it is so important and so impacting. But in this video that, and Al, it's just, if you type in Miles Monroe, his name is spelled M-U-N-R-O-E. It's on Why Men Have Vision. He talks about that Eve was brought to the man to be a helpmate. But if a man is not doing anything, she doesn't have anything to help him with because he's just sitting around doing nothing. So if you're sitting on the couch watching football and expecting your wife to help you, what in the world is she doing? You got to get up and do something before she can help. And then he goes into something that was impacting to me. And Barry, you're not the first one that that emailed me back or texted me or I've heard of that sat here and said I cried through most of it. He said, you know, the man is called to receive the vision. The woman is the incubator. Now think about that. If, you know, a man is a giver. I've told many men, and, me and Cole have done this when we talk together with men, that men, if you're waiting for your wife, you're receiving, you need her input so that you can be something of value. You're acting like a girl. Men are not receivers. Men are givers. And so we need to be finding the vision and then giving that vision to our wife to incubate And Dr. Monroe went on to say, if you give a woman a seed, she'll give you back a baby. You give her a house, she'll give you a home. You give her groceries, she'll give you a meal. You give her a sentence, she'll give you a paragraph. Or as Barry said, you give her an inch and she'll take a mile. That was Barry. Dr. Monroe didn't say that. But I literally had a friend of mine. I was talking with him recently. And is, you know, and this happened in our house, to be very open with you guys, that we have never been the people that sat and put a vision down on paper, a dream on paper. And so I said to my wife, I said, let's talk about this. She says, no, we're not going to talk about visions. You're going to go get a vision. And then I'm going to incubate it. I went, okay. So some friends of mine did the same thing. And the wife says, okay, what's our vision? He says, I got to go pray. Because if I give you my vision, it'll be too small. I got to find out what God's vision is.
Oh, hallelujah.
Yeah.
As you're talking, Mike, I'm thinking of a song from many years ago. My favorite band when I was growing up was Barry. It wasn't Led Zeppelin. It wasn't Southern rock. No, it was the Electric Light Orchestra. Yeah. I love these guys from England, you know. But there's this one song that they had in 1979. It was called The Diary of Horace Wimp.
Yes.
You remember that? Okay, and the song is about this mousy little guy who works as a clerk somewhere, and the chorus goes, Horace Wimp, this is your life. Go out and get yourself a wife. And he does that. He finds this beautiful girl, and he gets up the nerve and asks her out and proposes, and they get married. And the song ends with this chorus, Horace Wimp, this is your wife. Go out and get yourself a life.
Mm.
It's ironic, it's funny, it's sad, because it's true. And that is the exact opposite, Mike, of what Dr. Monroe has shared. Because if you don't have a vision and you're relying on someone else to get it for you, and if a young man is connected with this woman to be his wife, and he doesn't know exactly what he's going to do, then that's the outcome.
So we live in that generation. Go ahead, Barry.
Well, another thing that was stated in the teaching was that when a man proposes to a woman, he said the wrong question for the woman to ask is, "Do you love me?" He said that's not the first question you want to ask. The woman's first question should be, "So where are you going?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, don't you want to know if I love you? No, I want to know where we're going. Where we're going? If I marry you, where are we going? What are we going to be doing? Mm. Totally opposite. I mean, our movies, our entertainments, our novels, all the social and cultural input that we have is built on romanticism. How much, you know, a young couple can face any obstacle because they just love each other. Well, love is a wonderful thing. You know, it doesn't fill your belly when you hadn't had anything to eat. And it doesn't keep the lights on when you can't afford it. To pay mm-hmm. the light bill. At some point, somebody's got to have the vision for a job. And they need a job, not only a job, but they need a career. They need to focus, who am I, what am I called to do, and what am I going to be doing with my life, so my wife will understand what her role is.
You know, Barry, you've been listening to Miles Monroe, and here's the subtle difference in what you were just saying. Here's a quote from Miles. If you don't know where you're going, you will probably end up someplace else. Now, consider this, that in our modern day society, we're taught to go and get a job. But how many people, how many young men, young women go out and get a job but don't know what their purpose is? So this is what Dr. Monroe is trying to, it's a subtle thing here, that there's a difference in life between your, he calls it work, I think it's better to term it purpose. There's a difference between your purpose and your job. And your job may be used to bring forth your purpose, but your job can also be a hindrance to your purpose. So unless you understand that the job and the purpose are mingling together. There's a lot of people out there today that have a job and are miserable. Why? Because it is an absolute drudgery. Someone sent me this one the other day. Work without vision is drudgery. Work with vision is destiny.
So this past week's Torah portion, Vayechi,
yeah,
is the Torah portion that I was born in. And I have understood that my calling and purpose has been to awaken the house of Ephraim to realize their destiny,
yeah,
to call them back to that destiny. What I have been given and my toolbox to accomplish that is words. I use words in communication, in music, and teaching, and encouragement, and counsel, hopefully in the near future, the beginning of a book, and writing. That's my work. That's my work. I am to use my words, my ability to communicate, to call Ephraim back to his destiny and to his purpose, to be prepared for the kingdom. That's what I'm called to do. I took a job that I worked for 10 years. And at the beginning of the job, which was sales and the music and instrument field, but I was given free hand that if a customer wanted to talk about things Hebraic or Hebrew roots, that I could do sidebar conversations with them without penalty. It was understood that that was part of my purpose in being in that store. When that focus was no longer really available to me, the job played out. Actually, 10 years to the day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I still have a good relationship with the store, the owner, and the business, etc. But the job was a part. It just didn't pay some bills. It was a part of the calling. Now I have another personal business that I'm doing that is still opportunity me to do the exact same thing. So when you look for a job, it's not just something to bring money in the house. There needs to be a connection to your work, to your purpose at some point. We may not see it immediately, but it will play out. When Yah says, take this job, yes, sir, then we need to be looking in the middle of that job. What is it that helps me on this job to do my calling?
That's a good way to look at it, Barry. And as I look back over my life, you know, when I got married, I was already established as an Army officer, and the military was my career, and my vision was to serve my nation. So what the Lord has done through that, and by the way, my wife shared that vision, and we were able in our relationship to weather the storms that came, particularly when the vision got radically altered. And eventually, what Yah told me is, okay, it's not the nation of your birth, it's the nation I am rebuilding, restoring. The house of Ephraim to be reunited with the house of Yehuda to become the restored nation of Israel. So everything should build, and I can look back over my life and see where everything does build into that, including being on this radio program with the two of you, which is interesting in and of itself.
What do you mean interesting there, Al?
No, I have learned a lot of things, Barry, from you and Mike. It's been a year and a half now that we have done Remnant Road in this format with the three of us, and then Hanoch coming on frequently to give us insight from an Israeli perspective, and he'll be with us again in a few minutes. But I wonder, guys, is it now the good time to explain the transition that's coming upon us?
We have 3 minutes, so I'm okay, because it goes around. We didn't plan this first segment. But yeah, it appears that there's some changes happening for the three of us.
That is right. And folks, what's been building up to over the last several weeks as we've talked and prayed through things together and separately, it is apparent time for the Remnant Road is coming to an end, and we are reaching the destination. So to put it plainly, December 31st will be our last show. And after that, well, who knows? But it has been, you know, for me, it's been 3.5 years mm-hmm. on this yeah. program, starting out in summer 2015 with Daniel Holdings, and then with Mike and Barry and Hanoch in 2017 in August. So it's been quite a ride. But it does seem that transition is on us. Don't know exactly yet what's the next step for each one of us separately or collectively, because, guys, I don't think that we can get shed of one another anytime soon.
Probably not. It's kind of like a growth. But,
Gee, my thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Kind of a fungus among us kind of thing. And also what is going on, you know, what's the next step with Remnant Road or whatever changes are have to be made with Hebrew Nation Radio. So there's a lot going on out there in ministries and a lot of adjustments that are happening. I know Messianic Lamb's going through a major one right now. So this is a good time to be praying about, involvement, support, and just being there. We don't know where a lot of things are going, but as I spent time, you know, all three of us, we've been talking about this for a little while, and it's apparent this is where we need to head to. So this is what we're doing. And just want to, you know, we're going to do a wrap-up show here in a couple of weeks at the end of the year. But I appreciate you guys and how much you've poured into my life. I'm a better man for working with you.
That goes in both directions. Yes. So for one thing, Mike, the Israeli connections that you have brought to the program with Moshe and Leah, for example, and Miriam Vamosh and others, it has been an eye-opening thing to talk with these wonderful people. And there's more to it. In fact, we'll be talking more about some of that in a few minutes. But right now, as Barry says, the music is upon us. Hashem Moshia, Hamelech Yanenu, Hamelech Yanenu, Biyom Korenu.
A shining city on a hill, Yerushalayim. We're longing for you, Yerushalayim. We know where we belong, Yerushalayim. We're coming back home.
Welcome back to the Remnant Road with Mike Clayton, Al McCarn, myself, Barry Phillips. And one more time, thank you, Will Spires, for making us all homesick. Guys, we've been talking about purpose and men finding their place and doing what they're called to do so that their wife will know her calling. And it's kind of like the man puts up an umbrella for his wife to stand under and flow in her gifting. As Cole Davis says, Mike, it's time to turn your lioness loose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we don't want our lioness running off and being loose to her own agenda and her own purpose, we better have something other for her to do. And she wants to be a part of what we're doing, but we need to define that well enough for her to do it. I have a quote here, and I don't know whether I'm quoting someone else or is this something that came to me and I wrote it down, but the thought is, reveal to me the key that unlocks the door closed to me. And it seems like I was praying and was thinking about doors that just would not open.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's the fact that Yah is waiting on me to find the key. And I was thinking about Yeshua saying to his Talmudim, to his disciples, I give to you the keys of the kingdom. You know, we're walking around with keys in our pocket and we don't know what door they fit. Or we're looking at doors and don't realize that the key is in our possession if we could just figure out that we have the key. I heard someone say many, many years ago, he who possesses the keys has the authority of the keys. So, you know, it's time for us to kind of figure out how to put the key in the lock and turn the lock. Not every door is for us, but sometimes I think that Yah is saying, if you will just pay attention and learn the purpose of the door. You know, this is not just a cat curiosity thing where there's a door closed. I wonder what this is all about. And, you know, it's more than curiosity. It's purpose. that takes us through the door. There, that door leads to something purposeful. If we're not prepared for that purpose, why open the door for us?
Well, it's about finding that purpose and then managing the level of purpose that you're walking in so that you can then be trusted with a greater level of that purpose. And I go back to 1 Timothy chapter 3 says, if anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of Elohim's family?
Yeah.
So if we're not managing what we've been given today, and you and I have thrown this out on our Foundations for Life program in a couple of places, that I've had, you know, people through the years have said, oh, I sure do need a new car. And I'll look over at the one they got and say, the moment that you quit treating that car like a trash can and maybe take care of it, maybe then the Father's going to trust you with something better. But if you're not being a good steward of what he's given you so far and treating it like, you know, just kind of just, you know, basically treating it like junk, then why in the world should he give you something more? You know, a person that wants to go into ministry, you know, Al, we were talking about this earlier. Somebody that's wanting to go into ministry needs to learn how to take care of their own house first. Because if you take the confusion, if all you have in your own house is confusion, and then you take that from into somebody else's house, what are they going to have? They're going to have confusion.
Right.
Why do we have so many churches, messianic congregations that are walking in confusion today? Because there's confusion in the house. And until you settle the confusion in the house, there in the individual home, there's no way to settle it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. You went from committing to meddling.
There you go. Now, that's a consistent message in scriptures, and Yeshua taught on it consistently. The parable of the talents is a very, very clear presentation where, you know, the servants who had multiplied the resources given to them were the ones who were rewarded with even more. But the one who didn't do anything with the one talent given to him, well, it was taken away because he proved himself unworthy. Whoever's faithful in little will be faithful in much. Or as Yeshua says, if you're faithful in unrighteous mammon, or, you know, just plain old money matters, if you're unfaithful in that, then who's going to be give you anything more of real importance? So practically speaking, you know, I can even think in my own life, let's see, we could use resources for this and that, and, you know, more money in the bank to do this and that. And, you know, the Lord has said to me frequently, well, you know, what are you doing with what you got? How am I going to trust you with this much more if you're still not the effective manager of what I've given you? And I think if we are all honest with ourselves, we've all received the same kind of admonition.
Miles Monroe, a quote from him, he says, wherever there is no management, Yah retards growth.
Mm-hmm.
So where we fail to manage, not only is bad management going to give us a poor result, but Yah will intentionally stymie our results until we improve our management. So I'm looking at situations where I'm thinking, all right, I'm not getting the result that I want. And instead of fussing and complaining about it, especially where other people are involved, I'm realizing, okay, what is it in my management of these people do I need to do in order to get a better result? It's not yelling and screaming at people. It's teaching, training, and equipping. It could be they're not producing because they don't know how. Mm. So we need to teach and train.
Yeah, so this goes to, you know, if you're wanting to lead people, you can't lead a person to a place you've never been.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah, so I can't lead someone if I've never been there. I can't, you know, if I've never experienced the presence of the Almighty, how can I lead a person there? Because I don't know how to get there.
And oh, by the way, this comes out of left field, maybe. But talk about counter-missionaries, anti-missionaries, those who would want to persuade us that Yeshua isn't the divine Messiah. You know, how can they do that if they haven't met him yet?
Okay, that kind of threw that one out of left field. But.
I know, that threw it out of the left field, but it's just one of those things that has occurred to me for a long time. You know, I have known Yeshua since I was a boy, and the testimony I have is consistent with testimony of countless others over the ages. And I know my living Messiah, but someone who's, whether Jewish or agnostic or whatever, that wants to try to discredit him in my eyes doesn't hold water because they don't know him like I do. It's the same way if they're trying to slander my wife. They don't know her like I know her.
A man with an experience is never at the mercy of a man with an argument.
Ah, yes. Okay, so I did throw that one out of left field, but...
So, how can a person argue with a valid experience? Is you can't. Now, an experience, though, to bring this back to biblical principles, is that, you know, I could go to maybe Mormonism who say, you know, well, I felt this fire in my belly. It could have been too much pepperoni. The experience has to be in line with what is the written word. That's called the two witnesses, where there are two witnesses. So just because somebody has an experience doesn't mean anything if there's no biblical truth basis for it. Barry?
I'm thinking, you know, a little different twist to this. Mikey said you can't leave where you're not gone. Moshe spent 40 years out in the middle of nowhere because he had an entire nation that he needed to take through this same territory. He could not understand that the first 40 years. So we may be experiencing things in our lives that seemingly have no purpose, no right understanding, and feel like even that the Father has abandoned us. It could be that we're learning a territory to take someone else through.
Right.
So,
and how to do
never discount the time of small things or the time where you feel like you're alone in the wilderness. Pay attention to your surroundings. It's training for something.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Barry, to try to get us back on track with what you were saying to start this segment, you know, it is true that Yah would be holding the door closed until we are able to handle what's on the other side. Until we have effectively learned to manage, to deal with, to apply the resources at hand now. But there's the other thing. If you're doing it right, but your head is still beaten against a brick wall, it may be that our Father in heaven is waiting for the timing to be right and for other peoples to be ready to receive what you have to offer. And that's the case with Moses in the backside of the desert for 40 years. I'm sure he was a very effective shepherd of his father-in-law's herds and that he did very well managing his father-in-law's family business. He was doing everything right, but, you know, for the calling that was placed on him that he knew very well from his youth up, he's beating his head against a brick wall saying, oh, Lord, what have I done wrong? No, he hadn't done anything wrong. It wasn't time yet.
Well, in regards to timing in this, if he had been permitted to succeed in his first effort while yet in Mitzrayim, he would have led a Hebrew revolt against Pharaoh within the confines of Mitzrayim. And there would have been perhaps a Hebraic culture established in Mitzrayim.
Yeah.
But the goal was not to change Mitzrayim, but to get this nation back to their homeland.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So the goal here is not to turn America into a Hebrew roots nation. The goal is to raise up a people who are ready to go home.
Right.
So how can you do that if we got people that don't know where home is?
Ah, so is that the next step for us?
Maybe so.
Maybe so. And, you know, that's a valid point. Because as I look over the last several years and see what we have done in this Hebrew Roots movement, we have, as Laura Densmore was saying a few weeks ago, you know, we've circled the wagons and we've become insular and we've established our own camps here. But the people who need to know who they are not us. We know. Now, the people who need to know who they are brethren still worshiping on Sunday. And they need to know it not in a condemning way. They need to learn and have understanding the way that we learned it, something that enhances their life with Messiah Yeshua and gives it new structure and meaning and a destination. Mm. So how do we do that?
Yeah, Mike, how do we do that?
Go ahead, speak, boys, one. This one's going out, Al.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one way we don't do it is by calling our brethren pagan just because they do certain practices that we now no longer do. And we need to go back and recapture that which we've lost. Folks, this wedding that I attended, this very Christian wedding that I attended over the weekend, was such a reminder, you know, of the genuine love that's available in the church, the real community, the walking out of what it means to love one's neighbor as oneself. You know, Torah is still a strange word to them, and they don't worship on the Sabbath. But, you know, as Eddie Chumney has said years ago, they've got the heart of the Torah, and that should be the beginning of our relationship. And what's happened with me as I've come into this Hebraic understanding is it just makes that foundation ever so much stronger and makes the light shine brighter and gives me a greater hope and a passion to see this covenant nation restored in its fullness and to even greater glory than it was before. Because the son of David, a greater one than David, will be ruling it.
Mm. What's going to be restored is going to be restored to a level that the world has never seen yet.
Exactly.
You know, we are investing at the ground floor, if you will, in a kingdom the world has no imagination large enough to conceive.
Mm-hmm.
There will be one lone superpower in the earth in that day. And it will not be America.
Right.
We're about to see something unimaginable. Well, are we going to return to our agricultural society? I don't know. It would seem to suggest as such. But it will be agriculture, if so, like we've never known before. Is it going to be a technology-based society? If so, there are things about to be revealed in the realm of technology that will be beyond the scope of comprehension. Yeshua is about to come and unlock a lot of doors that have been closed thus far, because he holds the key.
Right. Barry, as you were opening this segment, you're speaking about us individually. It's a collective principle as well.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, as in the Lord God will withhold things from humanity because we're not quite able. Why have we not been able to travel to the stars yet? Well, because we would take this same corrupted seed with us. So in the kingdom, when all things are made new and we are able to walk this out with this new heart in this renewed covenant, then I would love to see space exploration happen. Right now, it's all speculation. And I think the most important thing that we absolutely have to get right is walking in obedience to our God. If we don't get that right, then everything else means nothing. And I'll tell you, I have seen Jews who walk right with their God. I have seen Christians who walk right with their God. And there are even others from other traditions or no tradition at all who I see are applying principles of Torah, even though they don't understand what they're doing. Kind of like what the Apostle Paul said about if the Gentiles walk out the principles of Torah, they are a Torah unto themselves. Yeah, that's what happens because God's put the spark into their hearts too, and they're responding to it. So maybe that's where we look for friends and allies and start building that way. Instead of based on, I believe, this interpretation of the scriptures, and you believe a similar thing, so that's the basis of our relationship.
Oh, but that's so much fun.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe not.
So, Mike, what is it about home that people need to understand, that if they understood, they would begin to have a yearning for it?
Well, it's something that we've prayed, we've been told, most of us have been told to pray all of our life. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in the heavens. or in the heavenly realm, to quote you, I think, more definitively there. So understanding the fact that we're in the diaspora, if even a person standing on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem today is in the diaspora, a Jew standing on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is in the diaspora. Why? The diaspora began when Adam, was kicked out of the garden. When he was kicked out of the garden, he was in the diaspora. Because what is the garden? The garden is a realm of an open heavens that heaven and earth connect together. We are not in that realm today. And for those that would just want to move to Israel, you're not going to find that realm. That realm will only be when there is a Messiah, a literal Messiah in a literal temple, on a literal Temple Mount in a literal Jerusalem. And that is what we should be longing for. Not just to take a tour to Israel, but for the kingdom to be established in Israel and us being a part of that kingdom.
So why would I want to go to Israel if Messiah doesn't go with me?
Why would I want to go now?
There are those that would sell out and deny Yeshua to get to the land in their estimation.
And I have unfortunately been proven right recently, and I take no glory in that those that will deny Messiah to enter the land will in the end have neither. But the land, it says that is the place that his eyes are upon daily. He never loses, his eyes are never away from Israel. And so if, as you've said, if we're outside of the land of Israel, we are in his peripheral vision. If we are in outside of the land of Israel, we're in his peripheral vision. So when I go to Israel, I am in the midst of what he is focusing on.
Hello.
Hey, man.
Hey, guys. So sorry. It's, the challenges of packing. How y'all doing?
Good. You got 3 minutes.
In Parshat Vayigash, we, of course, have Judah, approaching Joseph. So now that I've done my little piece of that, it's time to try to pack up and head back to Israel. Easier said than done, to be honest with you.
Well, in the words of Yosef when he looked at his brothers, do not quarrel as you're traveling.
You know, that's not bad advice, Mike. I got to tell you, that's not bad advice at all.
Yeah, I have some little insights into your life that allow me to say things like that.
Yeah, there's not. I've never flown with three bags before, so that should be kind of interesting. It costs a fortune actually, but I've got all this stuff that I've got to get out and get back to Israel. So away we go.
So you're at the end of the trip. You got a minute and a half. You're heading out tonight?
Yes.
All right. Very good.
Actually, well, heading out in the next 2 hours for the airport.
Okay. But, I know how much you love to travel. So, yeah.
This is a special little piece of hell just for me. Uh-huh. But anyway, love and hugs to everybody. Again, please stay in touch, guys. KolYehuda.com, KolYehuda.com. And as soon as the jet lag settles, I'll be working on the late June to July.
All right, take care, bro.
And welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Thank you. his people, and your radio station.
Hey, welcome back to the Remnant Road. It is December 17th, 2018. This is Al McCarn, along with Mike Clayton, Barry Phillips. And we go back today to Western Louisiana. We are very pleased to welcome today as our special guest, all the way from the city of Monroe, Matt Napier. Matt, welcome to the Remnant Road.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you a little bit over the last few months. You were on our side of the country at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. You were learning how to be a drill sergeant for United States Army. Yes, and we want to talk about that for a little in a little while. But let me just
butt in there just a little bit, Al.
Yes,
I'm going to be probably kind of quiet during this hour of the program. Because last time I talked to a drill sergeant from Fort Jackson, it wasn't a good experience. that was 32 years ago, and I'm still trying to get over it.
That's good.
Thanks, Matt.
That means you learned the lessons well. But Matt, you are also a follower of Yeshua. You are part of the leadership of a congregation in Monroe. Tell our audience a little bit about you and about your fellowship.
Yeah, so a little bit about myself. Matt Napper, I'm 34, I think. I'll be 35 later this month. So 34 years old, born and raised here locally in West Monroe. We have a lot of beards in our movement, but there's some other guys walking around my town with some beards that people commonly recognized as the Duck Dynasty group. But that's the era I grew up in. Sportsman's paradise, lots of outdoors and stuff like that. As you noted, I'm in the military. I'm what they call AGR, Active Guard Reserve, active duty for the National Guard. I work in recruiting and retention. And I was currently at the United States Army Drill Sergeant Academy there at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Came through and finished the program, got home. Graduated last Wednesday, but got home today. The family and I took a small vacation that included visiting some friends of ours down in DeRidder, Louisiana, their congregation. But mostly we stayed in Houston. But 17 years I've been in the military. I joined 2001, November, shortly after 9/11. Obviously, that impacted my decision to join and serve. After having a deployment in Afghanistan in 04 and 05, I went on to active duty for the National Guard and decided to make a full career out of it. So while I have 17 years total service time right now, I have right at like 14 and a half active duty, so towards an active duty retirement.
All of that may sound bewildering to those who don't understand the nuances of the United States Army and its various components, but I got a similar story. 29 and a half years total service. Retired with just short of 23 years active service. So thank you for serving this nation. And thank you for going through the rigors of the Drill Sergeant Academy. You know, someone's got to do it. It must be a special calling. And I am honored to be talking to one of those folks who has that calling.
It is rigorous, and it's a lot of good training that helps with our career, helped grow me as a non-commissioned officer, an NCO. I'm a sergeant first class, and also helped grow me as a person. So, and the military has done it. The military has contributed to my growth as a person throughout. I can say, go into my background a little bit more. People ask me, you know, your story, your testimony, how did you come to know God? And I tell them, you know, God brought me to Him through Islam and Lent, and people kind of get some bewildered looks, right? And the shortened version of that is I did a deployment in 2004, and we had an interpreter there, and, you know, I saw that the devout prayers that they did every day, I saw their seriousness towards their religion, and, you know, I thought to myself back then, I said, I've never seen anybody this serious about their service to God and Christianity. It impacted me in a great way. And I said, there's got to be either something missing or I'm on the, you know, wrong track or something like that. And, I never thought that would, you know, obviously that was the true way to walk with God or serving the true God. But later I came back a raging alcoholic after my deployment, like many people, and managing to cope with some stresses in life. And so my friends all bet me that I couldn't give up alcohol for Lent. I was going to a Methodist church at the time. We kind of do Lent. And so I literally was drinking every day. And so I said, well, I'm not one to back down from a bet. And so I took the bet, and about 15 days into my sobriety there for Lent, I realized that God had been trying to draw me to Him very, very fiercely over the past few years before that. And I surrendered completely to Him. And I'll never forget, I was sitting in a local park here, and I read the book of Ecclesiastes, and I said, calling back on my time in Afghanistan, seeing the seriousness, I said, I want to follow You, but I want to follow You with everything that I have. I want to know the fullness of Your truth. I want to know the fullness of what it means to be serious about walking with You and serving You. And within 6 months, He revealed the need to keep Sabbath, keep kosher, and all that to me. So within 6 months of my dedication to God, I was walking in tour. So that's a short version of it. But anyway, that's the background to my spiritual walk.
Now, Matt, you were not married at that time, right?
That's right. I was not married. I've been married 10 years this year to a wonderful wife, and I'm quick to tell everyone I do everything I do only because I have a great, amazing wife who makes my job as a husband and father easy.
Well, how did you meet her, and how did you finally end up getting married?
So, 10 years ago, well, after that sobriety, and after coming to fully surrender to God, I wasn't drinking in the bars anymore, so I had to find something to try to help wean me off. So what I do, I went to the coffee shop, and every night I was in the coffee shop reading and just after work. And one day this new girl showed up at the coffee shop as a barista. It was like 9 o'clock at night, and I went and ordered like a triple shot of espresso. And she said, how do you sleep at night? And I just very stoically said, well, like everyone else, I lay my head on my pillow and close my eyes. And she said, oh, you're one of those guys. And then so, it kind of went from there.
Love at first sight.
That's right. We were married about 7 months maybe after we met.
Was she already following the Torah at that time?
She was not. So she was going to a Baptist church. I'm going to show my hand a little bit. She she was engaged to a youth pastor at the time in a local Baptist church. And I had no ill intentions and did not pursue her until a couple of months after that engagement had ended for, I couldn't tell you what reasons, but God's reasons. But that engagement ended, and all of a sudden I said, hey, I started noticing her character. It was her character that really drew me to her. I think back to the time when Isaac found his spouse, or God found his spouse for him, and it was, he instructed the servant to look at her character when she came out. So I kind of did the same thing. I viewed her character, her work ethic, her ability to compose herself in stressful situations, and viewed her character as one that I wanted to have in a spouse. And so she wouldn't, because of her relationship previously, she wouldn't, she was very cautious at the time. So it was several months after that that we actually kind of started talking, but it was real quick after that. So, I, you know, it's kind of like once you know, I guess.
Yeah, I've heard that before. I've experienced that before as well.
So, that's right.
And for all you single folks out there, if you don't understand what Matt just said and what I've just affirmed, don't worry, you'll get there. When you meet that one, you'll know.
That's right. And it's a lot of hard work, and you know, marriage, it's a lot of hard work. Don't give up. If it was easy, everybody would do it, I guess, right? They say something like that. If staying together and being married was easy, everybody would do it, but it's definitely hard work. It's not something that's supposed to be easy. It's something that takes intentional dedication from each party.
But that it does. So you and Melissa have been married 10 years, and as soon as you were married, everything smoothed out, and you embraced this Torah walk, and you have no complications whatsoever with your military life and your family life with children and your congregation. Everything's perfect, right?
Everything's a breeze. Just look at me on Facebook, right? Everything's copacetic. Everything's kosher. Back to your original, I never did answer your question. So she was going to a Baptist church at the time. She wasn't on this walk necessarily. And one of the things that kind of got our conversation started in a platonic way initially was, you know, she noticed my TT Yotes and said, you know, hey, what are those? And I mentioned that. And similar to my story, someone who said, hey, look, I've never seen somebody so serious about their walk with God. She kind of looked at me and said, this guy is different. You know, this guy, he's very serious. He reads the whole Bible and he takes things that God says and he internalizes them in a way I've never seen before. And so that kind of drew her towards me. There was obviously, you know, some transition there and some growing, but one thing that makes my wife really amazing is her level of commitment to us as a unity. You know, we're a team, and she'll never allow that to be broken. So she had that mindset from the beginning. I'm going to go into this marriage with this man, and he's a man of God, and I'm going to be unified with him, and I'm going to learn what makes his relationship with God so strong, and she kind of followed from there. So she's amazing.
We've been talking in the first hour about something you're seeming to describe, and that is that it's important for the man to already know Yah, to have his presence, and to know where he's going. He knows what his work, his calling, and his purpose is. It seems like that you are saying you had those things defined before you met your wife, and that she chose to go with you in that path because you knew where you were going.
That's right, yeah. I can't say I had it figured out, but I had a clear direction from God for sure.
Now, were you already AGR at the time? And I believe you're a recruiter in Monroe right now?
Well, I work in recruiting and retention. I'm not actually a recruiter, but I work in recruiting and retention. I was. I had already been on active duty at that time. So for our entire marriage, I've you know, this is what I've done.
Okay. So she knew she's marrying a soldier. And was that something new for her?
Her dad was in the military, but it was kind of before she was born, so she hadn't lived through, you know, your typical military childhood or anything like that. But she understood the stories her dad had talked about. You know, he served all over the country, all over the world, Germany, different places, Panama. So she kind of had that background understanding of the military. And she came, I'm just now remembering this, she came into this marriage we got married in July, and I was set to deploy in September, and I got transferred just before that. But so she was geared up, ready to go into a marriage where I was going to be deployed for the first, pretty much the first year of our marriage. And if we have time, that's an interesting story now that I think about it. So the Torah instructs, you know, certain things. We know we're all familiar with the Torah, I think, if you're chiming in on this radio station. One thing that it instructs is that a man, when he's first married, right, that he doesn't go off to war for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I had prayed. I said, God, you know, I'm trying to follow your Torah. I'm trying to honor you in the way that you intended. Here I am. I'm about to not be able to abide by this. And I went into prayer and fasting for several weeks. And he answered that prayer by giving me a transfer shortly before stop loss came in. And I was able to be home with that first year my wife. So that was kind of a good affirmation with God at that time, you know, for me and for my wife.
Well, and Matt, that was exactly the question I wanted to ask. So this gives us an opportunity to look into that particular set of questions that I was hoping we would discuss. Now, both of us, and Mike also, we have this connection as soldiers. We've all served in the Army of the United States, and we've all, I think you and I in particular, have had to wrestle with the question of how can a godly person serve in uniform in the military? And looks like we have come up with similar answers. But you add to that this desire to honor Torah, and you have just spoken to the Torah requirement that, in Christian nations at least, certainly in the United States, no one thinks about that, that a young man who's just married a woman is not supposed to deploy or go to war for a whole year to enjoy his wife and to be with her. So what answers have you come up with of how to be a soldier and a Torah-honoring follower of Yeshua?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I have like a set list of answers with that. I think the most dominant theme for me in my life is the constant reminder that our God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Abraham, is an intimate God, one who is very concerned with us individually and as a whole nation of Israel, but even individually. He wants a level of intimacy with us, and that's reciprocated to us. So just like in that situation, no one in the secular realm would understand, acknowledge, or even give credence to my desire to follow that instruction. But through his divine interaction, he was able to make it happen. So I think that he can make things happen. I'll give you another example. Several years ago, you know, we keep Shabbat, we keep Sabbath. Several years ago, the state of Louisiana went to a four-day work schedule, and it just so happened that my schedule is offset from other schedule the way it was. I won't go into it. But anyway, I ended up with a schedule that's Monday through Thursday, four 10-hour days. And so I have Friday, the prep day. I'm able to stay home with my wife and prep for Shabbat, help clean the house, help do things around the house, help with cooking and stuff like that. So that's been an immense blessing, too, one that I could not have orchestrated. So I'm not sure that I have a set list of where you were trying to go, but understanding that God is very intentional about interacting with us and being reminded of that is very important.
Good word there, intentional, Matt.
I think that's one of my key words, intentional, because God's very intentional with us. He's very intentional with his nation as a whole. And a lot of times our relationships with each other break down because we're not intentional, right? We become complacent in our relationships, whether it's your marriage, your children, people in your faith community, stuff like that. We're just not intentional. And if you're not intentional, then the perception is there is that you don't care. If God was not intentional with us, then he would be like all the other nations who looked to their gods as people who didn't care for them and had no communication with them, right? So. Mm-hmm. I love that word. Yeah.
Matt, you were talking about coming back from a tour, a raging alcoholic. What is the real reality of men and women in service and their spiritual need? You know, we've all heard the term foxhole conversions and that kind of thing, but the average man and woman in the military, my brother is recently retired as a full colonel out of the Army. Stationed at Fort Jackson at one time, but he doesn't really talk a lot about those experiences. But there's a lot of loneliness. There's a lot of upheaval in the family, especially those that come back from a tour. What is their reality, and what is it that they're dealing with? And basically, how do we help them?
Oh, sure. Let me clarify. My diving into the bottle had nothing to do, or not much to do. Obviously, there were some stresses with reintegrating back to home life, but I don't want to portray that as my deployment caused that. I was heavy in the bottle before I left, and I was heavy in the bottle when I came back. So, but I did have friends who did suffer with substance abuse when they came back and stuff like that. I think the best way to help them, what they're dealing with, I tell people all the time, sometimes it's harder to come back. I remember thinking I was more stressed about coming home than I was about going over there. Because when you're there, you have one duty every day. You know exactly what you're doing every day. And there's no outside interference to your daily life, right? You're so hyper-focused on one mission, one goal, and one effort. And when you come back home, you have all these different stresses. If you're married, you have your spouse and your children. You have to figure out how to reintegrate there. You have the stresses of all your friends wanting to do this, or having to find a job for some people, or having to go back to a regular work schedule with all these other people that have demands of you. When you came from a place of a year long or so of having just one focused mission and one thing to do every day when you get up. So I think as far as what we can do is just look for those stressors, right? Or look for those signs of stress within our loved ones when they come back, and always be willing to speak up. Just my personal experience, this is anecdotal. I don't have any science to back it up. What I've seen most often is that people are too scared to speak up, and that leads to someone going farther down the spiral, right? And so just have the personal courage to speak up and say, hey, are you all right? Or sometimes have the personal courage to call the right person and say, this person isn't all right, needs help immediately. So, and I've had to do that several times.
And let me echo that, Matt. You are speaking truth. And, you know, I experienced the same kinds of things in the deployments I've had. And what I can say, in my last tour in Iraq in 2008, 2009, I was very encouraged to see the Army and the military in general taking steps to address these things.
That's right.
And for one thing, remove the stigma of seeking counseling, seeking mental health assistance, and trying to encourage people, particularly with suicide prevention, to watch and take action. Now, I think what was missing is the spiritual component, but it is it's good to see that the U.S. military has at least taken some of the right steps to help people where they need the help.
Oh, that's exactly right. And they, I don't want to say that they've, you know, give them an image of the military hasn't cared in the past. I think that they've learned how to better care today. Mm. And they definitely do. The Army goes along, military as a whole goes a long way to try to help soldiers. Like you said, remove the stigma of seeking counseling, remove the stigma of getting help when needed, and being able to reintegrate back into the unit as a healthier soldier. You know, the acknowledgement that we all go through struggles, but also the acknowledgement that we can all be helped and healed as well. So the military has learned how to better help its soldiers for sure.
That's right. It certainly has. And, you know, this comes a long way even from the Vietnam era.
That's right.
Maybe we can address that on the way back. We've got less than a minute, Matt, before we go to break. I came in right at the edge. My wife was actually in during Nam era. She was in Thailand. But I came in on the back end of it, and the morale was, it just wasn't there. It was bad. So you're talking about, you know, things that they've done to try to help out, and that it needed to happen. Really, really needed to happen.
Well, we are coming up on the break, so we will be returning in a moment to continue our conversation with Matt Napper from Beit Shalom Congregation in Monroe, Louisiana. In the meantime, just sit back and listen to the music as we take a break from the Remnant Road.
We are the children. We are the children of the light. We have a light. You're Adonai, Tabo, Boro, Shamostaga. I'm on my knees, won't you doubt I've come to praise your holy name. You're Adonai, Tabo.
Welcome back to Foundations for Life. No, it's not Foundations for Life. What are we doing, the guys?
This is Remnant Road. You want to start over?
Yeah. Can you rewind that music?
Actually, no, go ahead.
This is I actually am going through a little PTSD, which is what I go through every week as soon as I hear that stupid rooster. It takes me a long time to get over that. You just don't know, Al.
Well, we'll pray for you, Mike.
To Remnant Road with... Everybody is here.
Yeah. And tell us about our guest, Mike.
Well, Matt is, I mean, it's really is amazing that I'm actually even on the show today in any way, shape, or form, because this is bringing back the flashbacks. You know, anybody that's been in the military, the scariest day of your life, I remember in Jacksonville, Florida, getting on a bus. And the ride from Jacksonville to Columbia, South Carolina, with every passing moment, you could see the blood draining out of people's faces. You could see the attitudes and changes that were going on as they were wondering what is going to happen. And then that which you feared came upon you. The bus came to a stop. And this guy that was impersonating a gorilla with a hat on, all of a sudden was in the bus telling you to get off. You had made a few friends along the way as you're driving up there. You continue with these friends for a little while, and then they take you all in to get your hair shaved off, and you come back out, and the guys that you were talking to, you can't recognize who you were talking to anymore. That, my friends, is driving up to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and we have one of those people online with us right now.
Well, Matt, with that introduction, let me
go on to say this, because right on the other end of the show, we were talking about the things that are happening with the military and changes. I went in the Army in 1976. You know, we're talking about ancient history here, but it was a different era. All of the people, the drill instructors that I was with had just come off of Nam. I actually ended up going into air traffic control. I worked with trainers, with officers, warrant officers who had been in Nam. The morale in that day was at an all-time low. And, you know, it was, I don't know if it could have gotten any lower. And the Army even survived through it. It was bad days as the country had turned. You know, I remember going home on leave in the midst of basic training. They said, we're taking the Christmas break and you guys are going home. You're not sticking around here. So I actually went back to Jacksonville. I had my hair shaved and I went to with some friends to a Styx concert in Jacksonville, the Coliseum there. And it was not a very comfortable moment being in the midst of all of that. In the attitude of the military in that day.
And lo and behold, yeah, things have changed. But this gives me a chance to ask, Matt, why did you want to become a drill sergeant?
I have the same experiences from the first day I went to Fort Sill for basic training, but still remember the bus ride, still remember the shark attack the first, day one. But from that time, 17 years ago, I always view the drill sergeant as the most squared away, the one to be looked up to in the Army ranks. That brown round, that campaign hat that the drill sergeant wears is forever distinguishable. The drill sergeant badge that's worn on the uniform, forever distinguishable as the people who, are able to, who walk the line better than most, in the ranks. They say the top 10% of non-commissioned officers are able to become drill sergeants, so...
Matt, I have to echo that. I mean, I make fun about getting off the bus or anything, but I still remember those men. I remember them, the conversations I had with them, the respect that I had for those men was really above anybody else except maybe the trainer I had in the air traffic control tower. They were the top, and they had paid a price to get there. So I do applaud you for the efforts you're taking, and may the Father use that to speak into men's lives.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I can definitely attest to the, it's a tough school, toughest school I've been to in the military, so.
With good reason, because you're supposed to be the best of the best.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. I think we had, I forgot the numbers, but I'm pretty sure it was 43 people were dismissed from the course while I was there, so. Mm. We graduated 93 and 43 were dismissed, so that, it's pretty good.
Pretty good. That sounded kind of like air traffic control school.
That's right.
That was the toughest thing I ever did. I went through Oklahoma City back before the strike. I was actually fired by Reagan in 1981 during the strike. But in that day, we had a 60% washout rate.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Well, Matt, in the roughly 20 minutes we have left, I would like to find out a couple of things. First of all, you and Melissa are among the leadership of Beit Shalom congregation, so I'd love to know, how did that happen? And then second of all, in the announcement or promotion for this show, we referred to the story of Yeshua healing the centurion's servant, and that's in a couple of the Gospels, and that centurion's discussion about authority.
That's so right.
Let's go first to, how did Beit Shalom congregation happen?
Yeah, so like many people in this walk, we started years ago. I already gave my 30-minute introduction. I didn't know it was going to take that long. But years ago, we started keeping tour. It was just a few of us in a house. It started as a Sunday after church. We weren't, getting enough church. So we'd meet after Sunday at a friend's house in Ruston, Louisiana. I was the youngster. Everybody else was much older than me. And one day, one of the guys said, you know, I've been reading the Bible, and it talks about the Sabbath a lot. Maybe we should be meeting yesterday. And just like that, we started keeping Sabbath. And it kind of grew. So we had home groups that grew, and then grew into another home. You know, one of those three core men there went and kind of had to start another home group based on size. You know, you can only hold so many people in a house. And so 10 years later, we end up with three large home groups that are, again, spilling over. And one day I was praying, and I just felt this strong urge that we need to have a public congregation for multiple reasons. One, through my prayer, I felt that the leading to do that. But also, the Sabbath is the first of all holy convocations, gatherings together in a public assembly type setting. So I said, all right. And I talked to the people in my home group, and they were like, well, we've actually been feeling the same thing. And so I start seeing what it takes to get a congregation together. And I immediately was stopped dead in my tracks in my spirit. And it was, you're not going to go forward without these two other men. One's Nathan Hall. Nathan Hall, I've known most of my life. We ran track and cross country together. His family knew me in the wildest of my days. His family had been praying for me probably for 15 years when I came to know God. So that's Nathan Hall. And then Layman Tucker. Layman Tucker had another congregation as well called Bethel here locally. And so I contacted those two guys expecting, no, there's no way, you know, I was expecting the worst. You know, you always, if you have a fear of rejection, you're going to expect the worst. And I was received with, absolutely, that's an amazing idea. I think it's of God. And so that was 2.5 years ago. And so we're still serving together. Do we always agree? Absolutely not. But do we always stay unified and strong? Absolutely. So I love serving with those two brothers. I wouldn't have it any other way. We work great as a team, and it works like now. I was gone for 10 weeks, and those two guys were able to keep things going as if, you know, I wasn't, you know, as if nothing else had changed. So
a couple of questions now is, first of all, are any of you seminary trained, or do you have any of the usual credentials for congregational leader? And second of all, is this more than a congregation, as in, is Beit Shalom actually a community?
Yeah, we love to use the word community. We have people that come and go, and, you know, I say come and go, pass through the area and stop by, and we definitely have a community. It's not just a congregation where we meet on Sabbath. We definitely, we have elders that were appointed over different aspects of the community, hospitality, outreach, stuff like that. We do several methods of outreach. We help with the local soup kitchen. We help feed the homeless there once a month. We have what we call Yeshua Walk, where we meet at the congregation there in downtown Monroe, put on some backpacks with Bibles and waters, and hit the streets on feet and talk to whoever listened to us share about God. So, but it's definitely a community. As far as credentials go, you know, we all started just people that love God and were serious and dedicated about studying His Word. So we all, none of us had any kind of schooling. For me personally, afterwards, I felt a strong urge and accountability to somewhat get some training. I had a bachelor's degree through the University of Louisiana Monroe in social sciences, and the military pays for education. That's one of the great perks. So I went back to school. I ended up with a master's in Old Testament studies. Graduated with that this past May, and started the same month, started in a PhD in Old Testament studies as well. So I took one semester of that. I was one semester in of my PhD when I left. I took this semester off due to the school, the Drill Sergeant Academy, and I'll start back up in the spring. So,
wow, that's something. You know, we often will complain about the traditions and the denominational hidebound doctrines and such, but you know, there's a reason that this institutional training is there, and it adds some credibility to what you already know, what the Spirit of God is downloading into you from the Scriptures. And so I applaud you for pursuing this course. It's interesting that you have begun acquiring the degrees after you answered the call to move into leadership of this community.
That's right. And just answered that, you know, just did that as a sense of responsibility to better prepare myself to lead. And I would, you know, we get a lot of backlash on seminary in this movement. A lot of people not for it or whatever. I think they have a misunderstanding of seminary. And there's two sides. I would say, you know, there's a scholarly side, which is the side I'm on, master's, PhD, where you go to a school and it's all walks, all denominations studying together. And then you have the theological side where, you know, I go to a Church of Christ University. So if I was on the theology side, you would have to be the Church of Christ, all the professors of Church of Christ. And they teach more, you know, denominational doctrine there. But if you're on the scholarly side, you get real research in languages, the history, archaeology. They teach you how to truly study in a way that is very edifying. So,
In the study aspect, now that you bring that up, there's a lot of, how should I say this? A lot of study that's not really based on credibility. I mean, they're, you know, the first thing that comes up in a Google search or Google is their university and their theological training center.
Absolutely.
What is the pitfalls of that, and why should someone study in a different manner?
So when we do that, we have a natural tendency to try to find the answers that we're already seeking, right? We try to find what we're already looking for, and that's not real research. It's not real. Research comes from challenging your own beliefs. Some of my greatest growth has come from challenging my beliefs and saying, purposely picking up a book that I know is going to disagree with my preconceived notion, reading it, and sometimes it affects change in my understanding and my thought process. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it more solidifies where my stance was, but we have to challenge our beliefs to make sure that they're right. One of my pet peeves in this movement is really the languages, right? I mean, you've got YouTube and Google scholars on Hebrew saying a lot of different stuff that really just has no factual basis in history or scholarship or anything like that. So I'll give you my professor, my favorite professor. He's the dean of our department, and they all know where I walk, where I'm at, by the way. They know my faith walk and everything. I went to Israel with the university this past year. So they're very aware of where I'm at, but, you know, he's 55 years. He's been teaching at the collegiate level. 55 years he's been teaching Hebrew, and some of the stuff I asked him about that comes from our movement, he just kind of laughed and said, I have no idea how somebody could come to that conclusion. But,
and let me just interject here, folks, you have just heard from Matt Napper and an expression from the Christian side of what our brother Hanok has frequently been saying from the Jewish side. And, you know, Hanok's loving way of saying this is, y'all got to quit making this stuff up.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, yeah, we've got to figure out how to really research that stuff. But I'm looking at the time here. I don't know if we want to get into the passage. I'm kind of rambling on about school and stuff. But
this is great. Let's do that, Matt. You know, you and I have both spent considerable portions of our lives in uniform, and we've had to wrestle with this question of how can someone serve God and still be in the military? And, you know, that added aspect of how can you serve God and be a Torah observant follower of Messiah Yeshua? And I would throw in the other thing that we probably won't have time to talk about is, now that you know you're part of the covenant nation of Israel, how does that affect your service to the United States? But most of all, let's talk about this centurion presented by Matthew and by Luke, who talks about authority, and Yeshua says of this guy, this Roman, I've not found faith even so much as in all of Israel. Why did he say that, Matt?
Well, what stood out to me, and I want to say most of my focus in my studies, my scholarly studies, is Old Testament, but my number one focus is Yeshua, our Messiah. So I'm definitely very much into the new study the New Testament daily. But what came out to me when I saw that you said this passage was verse 8 there, for I also, this was his response, you know, or verse 7, wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to, I never read the King James, I'm sorry. That was preset somehow on my, I thought, man, I don't sound right. Okay. Verse 8, for I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he does, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do, and he does this. And when Yeshua heard these things, He marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith in all of Israel. And what came out to me in this passage and what really came to light in my personal walk through this was the appeal to authority. And this soldier was appealing to the authority of Yeshua and his ability and his authority to be able to make this miracle happen. And that's the one thing that as I go through this walk, especially the tour walk, and I didn't even know Mike Clayton was a former veteran. I apologize, and I appreciate your service. Al, you and I have had conversations. I knew that. But we see other people in this movement. I can name a few, but there's people everywhere in this movement that leaders in this movement that are former military guys. And I think that a lot of that comes from not only the fact that the Bible from front to cover, from front to back, is a book about war and battle in one sense or another, but also it's a book of authority. And when we come out of the structure of the military, we have a greater respect for authority and a greater understanding of authority and really a greater understanding of true leadership as well. And so I think those key factors make it easier for people like us, former veterans, in some way to understand, especially when we're talking about the Torah walk, a walk that that requires discipline and it requires respect for authority. I think that makes it a lot easier for us, you know.
Exactly. You know, when I see what that centurion said, I'm seeing 30 years of my life spoken in a couple of phrases. It's the chain of command. It's the one at the highest gives the orders. Those below obey the orders. You don't obey the orders, you suffer the consequences. There's got to be some trust both ways. There's got to be some understanding from on high that these subordinates are going to do what I say, regardless of why. You know, what's their motivation? Patriotism? Love the leader? I don't know. The fact is, it's there. The authority is there. It's recognized. The authority figure gives the orders and expects that they'll be carried out and doesn't have to follow up and micromanage.
That's right.
And on the other side, the subordinates listen, they obey because they know it's what it's expected of them. They know if they don't obey, the whole unit will suffer. In fact, even to the point of people will die in some cases. And there'll certainly be loss of honor and shame. But those are the consequences. And they don't question. They also have to trust that their leader has their, you know, is looking out for their best.
That's right.
Yeah. So, you know, do they have a chance to turn back and question and remonstrate, you know, or argue with the leader? Yeah, of course. But once the final word is given, their obligation is to obey.
That's right.
So Matt, how does that apply to the body of Messiah, or does it?
I think it does, and I find it fitting. I had no idea we were going to go this direction, but you know, just this past weekend, I assisted Joseph Good, and I officiated an ordination over our friend Joe Amon down in South Louisiana. And I brought up, during that ceremony, I brought up my background in the military, and I want to share here, the Army's definition of leadership is the process of influencing others to accomplish the mission by providing purpose, direction, and motivation. And I love that definition because it transcends all walks of life, but it definitely comes into our walk as a faith community. Our leaders within the body of Messiah, because we have Messiah as our ultimate leader, right? Yeshua gave us the example and led the way. We've run out of time, but there were so many examples throughout the scriptures and Psalms of God leading Israel in a military manner, leading them as a commander would lead his troops. But we also have the leadership that God has placed over communities, over groups of people to lead them in a horizontal way. And that definition there is very apt, that these leaders within the movement should be influencing others to accomplish our mission, which is what? To expand the kingdom of God by providing purpose, direction, and motivation. And on the flip side, which I think is where you're going, excellence is achieved when disciplined followers do their duty, commit to, and this definition says the Army values, but I would say commit to the biblical values, commit to the Torah, whatever you want to add there, and feel empowered to accomplish the mission while seeking to improve the organization, and our organization needs a lot of improvement always, with a focus towards the future, looking towards the future and the culmination of the kingdom here on earth. So,
Well said. And unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time with you. Matt, real quick, how would people get in touch with Beit Shalom Congregation?
So we're at BeitShalomMonroe.com, BeitShalomMonroe.com. The email address is on there as well. We're also on Facebook, Beit Shalom Messianic Congregation on Facebook, and we're on YouTube.
Well, Matt Napper, thank you for blessing us with your presence on the Remnant Road today.
Thanks for having me.
Who's rising up for all to see, but you did not know it, did ya? Well, you've seen it with your own two eyes. Brother Judah is alive, and Joseph.